Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, November 14th, 2024. Judge tosses Leach defamation suit for the second time. By Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Brewster County. Last Thursday, a judge dismissed a lawsuit by Jeff Leach of Base Camp Terlingua against Katie Schwartz of Marfa. The Honorable Stephen Abels, sitting in for a series of swapped judges on the 394th District Court, ruled for the second time in the defendant's favor, citing the Texas Citizens Participation Act, TCPA, which is intended to protect state residents from lawsuits retaliating against their expression of free speech. Leach versus Schwartz has had a complex and turbulent journey through the court system. Schwartz, who also goes by the last name Malum, alleges that on the night of June 27, 2019, her then-boss, Leach, had her pinned down and told her he gets what he wants. The climax to an emotionally heated series of discussions after Leach solicited Malum for a threesome with his partner, Anna Oakley. A week later, Schwartz approached the Brewster County Sheriff's Office to file a report about the incident, but declined to press charges. She told a few other friends and co-workers, and over the next few months, a trickle of women filed their own complaints against Leach, alleging a range of abusive behavior from groping to rape. On September 9th of that year, Leach filed a lawsuit alleging that he had suffered substantial loss of his reputation and severe emotional distress as a result of the allegations, which he maintained were false. The original petition did not name a dollar amount, but was seeking compensation for mental anguish and any money lost from his business as a result. Around the same time, stickers with the slogan, "Katie Lied," which Leach would later claim was a reference to a Steely Dan album of the same name, started popping up around the Big Bend region. Receipts produced in discovery showed the stickers were ordered by Leach's partner, Oakley. The Big Bend Sentinel first reported on the issue on November 13, 2019. Base Camp Terlingua was booted from the platform Airbnb a week and a half later, forcing the company to cancel reservations and shift to an in-house online booking system. Schwartz's counsel filed a motion to dismiss the suit under the TCPA for the first time on October 9, 2019, arguing that telling others about the alleged incident was within her First Amendment right to free speech. According to the State Bar of Texas, the TCPA was signed into law in 2011 to protect citizens from retaliatory lawsuits seeking to intimidate or silence them on matters of public concern. Filing a motion under the Act allows defendants to potentially avoid expensive and lengthy litigation. Once filed, discovery is put on hold until the court rules. Schwartz's motion argues that the spread of the news around small-town Terlingua wasn't an attempt to slander her former employer. In good faith, Schwartz believes she endured inappropriate and illegal harassment and assault while in the employment of Leach, to such a degree that she was required to do the following: discuss this matter with other co-workers, friends, family, and relevant community members, leave her employment at base camp, warn others of her opinion regarding the very real risks associated with plaintiff, and file a police complaint. While a judge ruled in her favor on February 6, 2020, Schwartz's TCPA motion was not filed according to schedule, thanks to a series of scheduling delays and hurdles. Getting a visiting judge to come to far-out Brewster County was difficult after District Judge Roy Ferguson recused himself early on in the case, and a significant court backlog contributed to the delay. Therefore, the court finds, even if some matters are untimely, there is good cause to consider the movement's motion to dismiss, Judge Stephen Abels wrote. Leach appealed the case, and the Eighth Court of Appeals did not agree with the lower court's decision to ignore the typical TCPA timeline. So the case was dropped back de novo into Abel's court in the spring of 2022. Almost simultaneously, 83rd District Attorney Ori White dismissed a building criminal case against Leach, who was indicted on rape charges involving a different alleged victim by a grand jury in February 2020. The new case set 2 years of a grueling discovery and deposition process in motion. In September of this year, Ray Lifesti, counsel for Leach, filed a second amended petition, which cut out much of his client's complaint about emotional distress and instead focused on harm to his business caused by allegedly defamatory statements spread in the media and word of mouth. Jody Cole, counsel for Schwartz, quickly filed a new TCPA motion, arguing that Leach's most recent petition was different enough from the document filed almost 5 years earlier that she could reset the clock. Lifesti fired back, sending the judge a side-by-side comparison of the two documents and imploring him not to be swayed by false statements and additional falsehoods. On November 7th, Abels ruled in favor of Schwartz a second time, agreeing that Leach's second amended petition introduces new essential facts, specifically allegations that the defendant made defamatory statements about actual rape and other undefined inappropriate sexual conduct. TCPA dismissals cover reasonable attorney fees for defendants, which the judge has yet to determine. Schwartz's first TCPA motion to dismiss requested $5,000. Cole was elated by the judge's dismissal. Katie's victory is a win for us all and a stand for freedom of speech, she said. This case was about defending our constitutional rights, and last week we won together. For Schwartz, the fight is not yet over. A countersuit against Leach and Oakley, filed in July 2022, is still pending. Over 5 years after I was sued for telling my truth, I finally feel some sort of vindication, she wrote to the Sentinel. I stood my ground all this time for the same reason I filed a police report to begin with, to protect women. We should all be able to speak freely about our experiences to protect our community, and I will always fight for that. Leach and Lifesti did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Photo by Jennifer Pittenger. Sam Cook, who leads taxidermy work at Hip-O, works on a new mount at the shop in Alpine. Longtime taxidermy business closing its doors. Root of legal battle is requirement for a grease trap at Alpine's Hip-O. By Rob D'Amico, Rob at BigBenSentinel.com. Alpine, Hip-O taxidermy, a fixture where Big Bend hunters had trophies mounted and meat processed for more than 15 years, is soon closing its doors after the city of Alpine cited the business for refusing to install a grease trap, according to accounts from several city officials and the business owner. Howard Parsons, who runs Hip-O with his wife April, posted to Facebook last week, notifying hunters that need to look elsewhere for services as mule deer season approaches. Due to the actions taken by the City of Alpine restricting our ability to operate our business, we will be closing shop, the owners posted. Many Facebook users commented that it could significantly impact hunters because there are no other nearby options for processing game, Fort Stockton being the closest. Parsons told the Big Bend Sentinel he will likely close for good in early December after they finish final mounting projects already underway. The conflict is more complicated than objections over a grease trap that costs a few $100s, and it is the second recent dust-up with a taxidermy business that has left Alpine residents wondering if their city has grown up to be a professional bureaucracy looking out for its infrastructure, or if it's too aggressive in enforcement of its rules. Robert Rux, the head of Alpine Building Services for the city, resigned on November 6th after a conflict he had with the city's top management over a zoning ordinance. He told the Sentinel he felt that the city actually wasn't doing enough to follow rules of good governance, and that with so much conflict in the ranks of employees, he didn't feel he could make positive change. The city will now be looking for its ninth head of building services in less than a decade. In interviews with Rux and three former city employees who worked on the taxidermy issue, they outlined what they said happened. Early this year, two city inspectors went to Hemp O and had an informal conversation with owner Howard Parsons. When they asked Parsons if he had a grease trap and commercial dumpsters, which they said was required by city code, he said he did. Two code compliance inspectors then returned later and said it was clear to them he did not have a grease trap or the proper dumpster service. Some supporters of Parsons posted on Facebook that it was on that return trip that a code inspector and the city's environmental officer illegally went through a gate to inspect the dumpsters. Rux said he doesn't know the details of that claim, but said he was told the inspectors had the authority to be where they were. The city then began sending letters to HIPO and eventually issued a citation for no grease trap and improper dumpsters. The Sentinel has requested those documents, but they were not available by press time. Rux said the dumpster complaint was resolved and the citation dropped. Howard Parsons said that on the advice of his attorney, he would only comment on limited details involved in this story. Alpine Municipal Court records show the Parsonses were on the docket for a hearing on the citations twice, and Alpine City Secretary Gio Calderon said they have indicated they intend to fight the charges with a jury trial in municipal court, likely in January. The Sentinel has requested court records, which were unavailable by press time. Rux said he and another city employee initially went to HIPO as a courtesy to make sure they were compliant with all codes because another taxidermy business in the city had faced issues for no grease trap. However, another city code compliance officer, Catherine Reese, who left the city in June, said a neighbor to the business had complained of the smell coming from the dumpsters. Rux said that after the city sent letters to the Parsonses, there was a tense meeting on the issue. I told him it was pretty clear he's going to have to come up to compliance with the grease trap and the dumpsters. And he said, I'm not doing anything. I don't think I need to. Grease traps are required by city ordinance for any business that cooks or processes foods to keep grease from clumping in the wastewater lines and blocking them. Cassandra Woolsey, who formerly worked for Alpine's water utility and left this summer, said lack of traps or non-functioning or unmaintained traps are a serious problem for the city's wastewater service. I can't tell you how many times the water department has to jet the sewers, and we were constantly jetting out big clumps of grease, Woosley said. Rux said that he told Parsons that if cost was an issue, he found grant programs through the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, TCEQ, and that he knew a plumber in town that likely would do the installation for trade, since the plumber was a hunter. Rux said Parsons replied, "If y'all force me to put in a grease trap, then I'm just going to shut down the processing portion of my business and let everybody know why I had to shut down." Rux, who said he is an avid hunter, said he then explained to Parsons why a trap was needed. "I said, you're processing meat, which has fats and runoff, such as blood and whatnot, and all that has to be caught. It's a city ordinance because it's also a state law, per TCEQ. Since Parsons only had a small sink, it didn't appear that the installation of a trap would cost more than a few $100s, Rux said. Businesses are also required to provide the city with receipts for maintaining the traps every 3 months, he said. Reese said she felt the city staff were doing everything they could to try and help Hippo move forward. He, Parsons, came to our office and he wasn't happy with what he was hearing, she said. It was a simple solution that he just didn't want to do. I did the same process with the American Legion, who also threw a fit and told me, 'We can't believe you're doing this,' Reese added. I told them, 'I'm a veteran. I stand for exactly what you guys are here to support. I have to be fair across the board.'" Is a grease trap really needed? Parsons confirmed to the Sentinel that he didn't have city water and used a well and had a septic system instead of city wastewater, which seemed to counter the concerns city officials had about grease getting in their lines. The business is located on the eastern edge of the city limits on Highway 90. However, Rux said that when septic tanks are pumped, the water and solids are taken to the city treatment plant. So any grease collected from the tanks will end up in the water treatment system, which is in continual need of maintenance and repair. You can go over there and see all the greases and fats floating around inside the wastewater treatment facility, and it clogs up pumps and screens and all kinds of stuff, Rux said. When grease traps are cleaned, they are taken to a grease pit at the city landfill. Companies hauling grease and septic waste pay the city fees to dump at the city facilities, he said. Parsons said he had never had the septic tank pumped. It's unclear if that meant since he bought the business in the summer of 2021 or in the 15 years the business has been running. The Alpine Code is simple and says that if you discharge grease or oil as a business without quantifying how much, you need a trap. TCEQ lists taxidermists under its charge of regulatory authority and lists related regulation areas, including grease traps and waste disposals, but officials did not immediately return a request for comment on what exactly is required. Zoning case closes a separate business. Noe Lujan ran a small taxidermy business, Desert Trophies, out of a shop next to a home in Southeast Alpine on Avenue H. City officials said that unlike Hippo, he didn't process any meat and only did European mounts, just receiving the heads to clean for a mounted skull and antlers. Reese said the city received a complaint near the beginning of this year about a bad smell coming from Lujan's dumpster, and when the city inspectors arrived to check it out, they realized he was running a small taxidermy shop and that a boy was hosing animal matter off of some pavement. Lujan denies this ever occurred and said most of his work involved a bucket of soapy water. The city confiscated the dumpster, Reese said, but no animal parts were found in it. City officials told Lujan he would need a small grease trap, but in the end, the grease trap didn't matter because the city discovered he was operating the business out of a property zoned residential. The news came as a surprise to Lujan, who had seen several businesses operate there throughout the years, and his mother-in-law, who owned the property, and family always thought it was zoned commercial. Lujan was right, sort of. City Secretary Gio Calderon said that in 1994, the property was zoned from residential to commercial, but it was done at City Council by a resolution, not the legal way, as it should have, with an ordinance. They had a legitimate issue, Calderon said. However, an attorney for the city said the residential designation had to be left in place. Lujan and his wife, Crystal, submitted an application to change the zoning to commercial this spring. The application was denied by the Planning and Zoning Commission on April 22nd, and then the City Council on May 7th. Calderon said the problem with their strategy was that since the property was in the heart of a neighborhood, it constitutes spot zoning, a new zoning classification being given to a property that is incompatible with adjacent lots, which is illegal in Texas, with a few exceptions under law. Rux, who arrived at the city just as the case was going to planning and zoning, said he felt bad for Lujan because it wasn't his fault for not knowing the commercial zoning was invalid. I've personally had him taxidermy some of my stuff. He does a great job, Rux said. Woosley, formerly with the water utility, followed that case and initially thought the city might turn a blind eye because the business was so harmless and she believed Lujan was close to city officials. But she said she eventually realized that wasn't going to happen and the business would be shut down. It is a huge health and safety issue, Reese, the former code inspector, said. He was throwing the carcasses into the trash receptacles. We did not cite him for any of that. We just gave him the warning notices. And he didn't deny anything with the taxidermy. I just explained to him that you can't do this here. Rux said there still may be a way to address the zoning issue, but city officials said it's unlikely because they don't believe you should be dealing with any kind of animal work that creates waste, no matter how little, in a neighborhood. Calderon said he thinks what triggered city staff to inquire about HIPPO was that code inspectors had just dealt with a grease trap issue with Lujan and decided to do the courtesy call Rux described to Parsons. The Sentinel previously reported on city inspectors taking a more proactive approach to ensuring commercial businesses are following all codes. Photo by Jennifer Pittinger. Sam Cook works on an owdad at HIPPO Taxidermy. Timeline undetermined for Holland Avenue fire cleanup by Mary Cantrell. MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. Nearly 6 months after a fire destroyed a 1911-built structure housing several local businesses on Holland Avenue, a timeline for the cleanup of the site has yet to be determined. While the property remains in the care of current owner Bill Ivey, the city itself has emerged as a potential buyer for the building located in a historic section of downtown Alpine. City Council directed City Manager Megan Antrim to head up negotiations with Ivy on a potential sale on September 17th. Antrim told the Big Bend Sentinel the city is continuing to work with Ivy on next steps, but a sale is not yet finalized. Ivy said he is still considering several options for how to move forward. The fire, for which a cause was never officially determined, completely destroyed the building located at 109 to 115 West Holland Avenue. The day after the fire, the area was blackened by smoke and ash. The roof, walls, and building contents succumbed to the flames, leaving behind nothing but smoldering piles of rubble. In the days following the tragedy, a temporary wall, paid for by Rick Stevens, not in his capacity as a council member, was erected to keep the public out of the scorched site. Discussions soon ensued at the city level regarding what to do with the now vacant site, with the mayor and the city council members recognizing the greater need for a revitalization of downtown Alpine. Ivy said he is currently awaiting two bids from local contractors to see how much it will cost to clean up the site. "I have no idea how much the bids will be, if I can even afford it," Ivy said. "That's the next step, is to discover how much it's going to cost to clean it up." "It's a very slow process," he added. "We're doing the best we can considering the situation." The city required that Ivy have an asbestos inspection completed in order to discover whether it was safe to dispose of the wreckage in the landfill, Antrim said. The Texas Asbestos Health Protection Rules and EPA regulations require that an asbestos survey be done prior to renovation or demolition activities. Ivy said it took 2 to 3 months to get the asbestos inspection completed. The Sentinel obtained a copy of the asbestos report from the city, which is dated August 2nd. The site was surveyed by a Texas Department of State Health Services, TDSHS, licensed asbestos inspector on July 5th. The inspector collected 31 samples from 9 different areas of the wreckage, noting in the report that additional suspect but unsampled materials could be in walls, voids, under debris, or in other concealed areas due to the condition of the building. Of those samples, low levels of asbestos were found in both the off-white wall plaster on brick cement block in the antiques shop and in the built-up roofing located in debris throughout the building. The report recommends that while the wall plaster is exempt from the requirement for regulated approval, it should be removed by a TDSHS-licensed asbestos abatement contractor prior to demolition. The asbestos-containing roofing may be cleaned up without an abatement scope of work or may be demolished in place with the structure, according to the report. The report also recommends that if the plaster found in the antiques shop remains in place during demolition, someone properly trained is on site to ensure disturbance of the material does not cause airborne fiber counts to exceed OSHA permissible exposure levels. The same goes for the roofing. Antrim said, with these results, the city can okay the disposal of building materials at its landfill. She said compliance with the air quality standards during demolition will be up to the building's owner to enforce. Ivy said potential buyers who have contacted him were interested in the results of the asbestos report, and now that it's complete, he can figure out what to do with the property. It is possible that Ivy could sell the structure as is, with a potential new owner agreeing to perform the demolition and cleanup. He said he has an interested party, which he declined to disclose, willing to take the site as is, who is formulating a bid for his consideration. "Everything's on the table," Ivy said. I'm open to all suggestions, all offers. But he noted he doesn't want to see the site taken over by another dollar store, for example. I will be particular on who I would sell it to, Ivy said. They would have to have good intentions to help the downtown district. According to documents obtained by the Sentinel, the city's code enforcement department did send a letter to Ivy on September 5th, notifying him of a dangerous building violation. The building official in charge at the time, Robert Rux, has since resigned. The letter states that compliance is mandatory, and after 15 days, a citation will be issued. It also states that minimum court fees start at $81. The remainder of the building and debris needs to be abated, as well as the temporary wall that is encroaching on the public right-of-way, the letter states. The entire property must be demolished and disposed of properly, including all walls unless proven otherwise. Please put proper permits before abatement. Ivy told the Sentinel he became aware of the letter after finding it in a pile of mail just last week. He said he was confused about the temporary wall issue the letter broached, considering the city wanted to put it up to discourage people from entering the area. Ivy said he is aware of the fact that he will likely need to pull permits for the demolition and cleanup process, including a potential permit to close the alley behind the store and another to utilize a nearby parking lot, but that the letter was discouraging and made it seem like the city is not willing to understand that this is not a process that's going to happen overnight. It's not just, let's go in there and clean it up, Ivy said. There's a lot of hoops to jump through for permitting and all of that just to get started. Antrim did not express concerns about how long the cleanup process is taking, but said the matter has been discussed in City Council executive sessions. She said she is unaware if Ivy has been issued a court date regarding the citation. Ivy said he has complied with city requirements and that the delay in getting the situation remedied is not due to resistance on his end. It's not out of not caring or anything like that, Ivy said. I do care very much about what happens to that piece of property because it is just a horrible scar in our city. Staff photo by Mary Cantrell. The aftermath of the Holland Avenue fire on Memorial Day. The building remains in ruins. Its current owner is in negotiations with the city, who is interested in purchasing the property. Historic hotel renovations await final investor. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL, at BigBenSentinel.com. Tri-County. Plans for cosmetic renovations to three historic Big Bend hotels, the Holland Hotel and Maverick Inn in Alpine, and the Hotel Olympia in Fort Davis, announced in August 2023, have stalled while owner Byways Hospitality awaits a final investor. The Austin-based company purchased the three properties from previous owner Charles Mallory and took over operations in January 2024. Selective demolition has taken place at all three properties, but a lender backing out of the project in August and other issues have led to delays. Company co-founders Colin Bibb and Brian Carrico said progress has been made on finalizing design plans, securing other investments like an energy efficiency loan, and obtaining tax credit approval from the Texas Historic Commission and National Park Service, all three properties will be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Historic tax credits help offset rehabilitation costs up to 25%. Carrico said with everything else in place, they are optimistic they will close on a construction loan in early 2025, despite initial setbacks. We still have the energy efficiency financing in place. We still have the investor financing in place. And we still have the tax credits in place. So that put us in a position in August where we needed to go back and find a new lender, Carrico said. That's what we've been doing since then. And in the current environment, that just takes a while. In the meantime, our focus is just trying to continue to operate the properties the best we can in their current state, continue to take care of our guests that we have staying with us, continue to take care of the staff, and focus on training and getting ready for when we do start construction, he added. Current staff will remain employed, and once renovations are completed, Byways Hospitality anticipates growing its workforce. While the hotels will have reduced capacity during construction, the company is hoping to phase work so none of the properties have to fully close down. The Century Bar and Grill, located within the Holland, has been closed since January when Byways began the selective demolition process. Carrico said they made the decision to keep the restaurant closed throughout construction because they are moving it from the southeast to the southwest corner of the building where it was originally located. Alexa MGMT, a company co-founded by Carrico and his wife Bree, is currently managing the properties. Byways Hospitality was previously under contract to purchased the Harvard Hotel in Fort Davis, but the seller backed out when the lender decided not to move forward with the project. Carrico said they are keeping in touch with the current owners. The property is still listed for sale for $1.4 million. While financing gets worked out, the company has brought in several consultants, including Post Oak Preservation Solutions and its architect, Baldridge Architecture, to help study and document the buildings, all of which are roughly 100 years old. Structural and engineering evaluations have been completed on all three properties, Carrico said. I certainly understand that from an outsider's perspective, it looks like not as much is happening, Carrico said. But in reality, we've had an army of consultants in the background working on these things. Byways Hospitality reviewed 3D model renderings of the planned renovations with the Big Bend Sentinel, but declined to share them for publication. The updates, largely cosmetic, involve staying true to the original visions of the properties while modernizing HVAC, plumbing, and electric services. Mallory, the previous owner who remains a partner in the project, last renovated the structures in 2012. One consistent theme here is that they'll be brought up to modern standards, meaning that they're going to have highly energy efficient HVAC, they're going to have modern electrical, they're going to have water efficiency incorporated into all the plumbing fixtures, Carrico said. But that is primarily from a cosmetic perspective, meaning that we're trying to avoid gut renovation as much as possible. There's also an effort to cater to modern guest sensibilities for more spacious rooms and bathrooms while delivering the Western flair out-of-towners are seeking. Custom-designed wallpaper in standard guest rooms at the Holland will feature Alpine's skyline. The 27-room Holland Hotel was built in 1928 and designed by Henry Trost, a well-known architect with a firm based in El Paso. It's had many lives, once even serving as an office building. Carrico said certain modifications made over the years will be removed in order to restore the grandeur of the original lobby and bring back a ballroom that was once converted into a one-bedroom apartment and games room. A new check-in desk that closely resembles Trost's original design will be installed next to a bar. Off of the lobby will be a lounge-style room with a library and fireplace that opens out to the existing courtyard. They refer to the Holland Hotel in the history of Alpine so much as the living room of Alpine, so we want to recreate that feel, Carrico said. The Maverick Inn, believed to be the longest-running motor court in Texas, will retain wood ceiling and Saltillo tile features, but will undergo bathroom renovations and more. Similar to the Holland, some rooms will feature pedestal sinks in the main room, per original designs, which will help make room for larger walk-in showers in the bathrooms. The pattern of adobe stair-stepped walls surrounding doors on the Maverick Inn property will be mirrored in the rooms. In Fort Davis, the Hotel Olympia pressed tin ceilings will remain, and carpets will be removed to allow for the refinishing and staining of original hardwood floors. The Orchard Building, located behind the hotel, which was built in the 1920s as apartments for MacDonald Observatory researchers, will be transformed into spaces that accommodate more guests. We think it's a really functional use of the space because now it'll accommodate families a lot better, or groups of friends, because instead of being a one-bedroom apartment with the kitchen, where very few people are using the kitchen, we'll have a one-bedroom plus a bunk room, Carrico said. The Blue Mountain Bar and Grill, once the electrical plant for the hotel, is also getting a facelift. It was not deemed a historic structure, however, so it will not require the same stringent demolition documentation and design review as the Century. Bibb and Carrico said they are excited about their plans for each space and look forward to getting construction underway in earnest soon. The project comes at a time when the city of Alpine is seeking to grow economic development following the Holland Avenue fire in May that destroyed several long-running local businesses. City Council also approved the expenditure of $39,000 for the development of a historic district survey that will help pave the way towards establishing downtown Alpine as a National Historic District, a move that would allow for more business owners to apply for tax credits for restoration projects. Once renovations are complete, Carrico said the company hopes to share the improved spaces with local, not just visiting, customers. If these hotels are successful in the future, it's going to be because the locals are a huge part of that. So much of the business is going to come from locals and the restaurants, Carrico said. We want locals to be proud of these spaces, ultimately, when we're done. Photo courtesy of Byways Hospitality. Byways Hospitality, an Austin company that bought three historic hotels in the region last year, is planning various cosmetic refreshes at the properties. The current lobby of the Holland Hotel, designed by architect Henry Trost, will see its check-in desk restored under new plans.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, November 7th. Voters give nod to themes for Precinct 1 Commissioner. Stogner named 143rd District Attorney. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Guy Thames was elected to serve as Ward County Commissioner, Precinct 1, and Sarah Stogner won the race for 143rd District Attorney. Ward County has 7,058 registered voters and a total of 3,833, or 54%, voted in Tuesday's election. Thames received 416 votes, 144 more votes than incumbent Jumentino Tino Sanchez, who received 272 votes, according to the official results from the Ward County Clerk's Office. Thames will serve as commissioner for 4 years. Quote, "There's a lot of needed work ahead for Precinct 1. I already have short-term, long-term, and in-between-term projects planned for Precinct 1 that I will begin to implement on the day I am sworn into office. My Precinct 1 constituents can feel free to contact me anytime with questions or concerns, Thames said. The only other contested race for Ward County voters was the 143rd District Attorney race against incumbent Randy Reynolds and challenger Sarah Stogner. Stogner won the election with 4,081 votes to Reynolds' 2,527. In Ward County, Stogner received 2,542 of the votes to Reynolds' 937. In Reeves County, Stogner received 1,491 votes to Reynolds' 1,550. In Loving County, Stogner received 48 and Reynolds had 40 votes. Quote, "Thank you to Ward, Reeves, and Loving County voters. I look forward to serving and making our community safer and stronger. Violent criminals have 56 days to get out. They should consider this their formal eviction notice," Stogner said. District Judge, 143rd Judicial District candidate Alan Nicholas ran unopposed and received 2,863 votes. Quote, "These contested elections can really pull bad blood to the surface. I think the most important action any of us can take now the elections are over is simply to look forward and not look back. I'm looking forward to working with the newly elected District Attorney, Sarah Stogner, in the coming years, and I'm incredibly thankful for the years of service District Attorney Randy Reynolds has given to the 143rd. I read a quote in a book once that said, "Every beginning contains the seeds of its own ending." I personally believe the opposite to be true. Every ending contains the seeds of a new beginning. Time to get to work, Nicholas said. United States Senator incumbent Ted Cruz won his re-election bid, securing 53% of the vote in Texas. Challenger Colin Allred received 44% of the vote. In Ward County, Cruz received 2,927 and Allred received 710. Libertarian candidate Ted Brown received 85 votes. The race for District 23 United States Representative with incumbent Tony Gonzalez and challenger Simone Limon proved fruitful for Gonzalez, with him securing 62% of the vote to Limon's 37%. In Ward County, Gonzalez received 3,068 votes and Limon received 549 votes. In the race for Railroad Commissioner, incumbent Christy Craddock won with 58% of the vote to challenger Catherine Culbert's 37%. Libertarian candidate Hawk Dunlap received 2.6% of the votes. In Ward County, Craddock received 2,637, Culbert received 547, and Dunlap received 307 votes. The new local elected officials will be sworn into office on January 1, 2025. Axe-wielding man given 8 years in prison. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man who was arrested for allegedly threatening, wielding an axe, and breaking a door of a home last November has pleaded guilty and has been sentenced to prison time. Fabian Armendariz, age 40, of 1901 South Stockton, appeared in front of Judge Tryon D. Lewis on October 29th and accepted a plea agreement to one count of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. According to the terms of the plea agreement, Armendariz was ordered to serve 8 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. he was also assessed a $1,500 fine. The sentence comes after an incident which occurred on November 3, 2023, shortly before 6 p.m., when Monahan's police officers were called to the 500 block of West 4th in reference to a disturbance and a man with an axe. At the time, Monahan's Police Department Chief of Police Christopher Quintana said, quote, "When officers arrived, there was a man standing out front of the residence holding an axe in his hand. Officers were able to get the man, later identified as Armendariz, to put the axe down and detained. Officers spoke with the female, Paris Haynes, who said she was trying to get inside the home and Armendariz began swinging the axe toward her and she couldn't get inside," Quintana said. The victim told officers she was in fear for her life because Armendariz threatened to kill her. Haynes was finally able to obtain entry into the home and told officers Armendariz was still swinging the axe at her through the glass front door of the home, which he allegedly broke while trying to get inside the home, Quintana added. James Matthew, age 35, was also an occupant of the home and was present when the disturbance took place. Armendariz was subsequently taken into custody and charged with criminal trespass and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. The charge for criminal trespass was dismissed. Local veteran Santana Carnero was 101st Tiger Force. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. Santana Carnero joined the Army at age 18 after taking the Army test while in high school. He told his teacher he wanted a hall pass to go take the test. After convincing his teacher he knew exactly what he wanted to do, he got his pass and took the Army test. Carnero enlisted in December of 1960 and came home in December of 1963, at which time he came home to Grand Falls for a short while. Within a short time, Carnero was back in the Army in Airborne. Quote, "I spent the next 6 weeks going to jump school at Fort Benning, Georgia," Carnero said. After graduating from jump school, he became a supply clerk at Airborne at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, until he left for Vietnam in November of 1965. Quote, "When I got to Vietnam, I volunteered for recon, infantry recon, in the 101st Tiger Force. I told my commanding officer I wanted to have action," Carnero said. The Tiger Force was an all-volunteer organization of about 60 members. The Tiger Force troopers were outfitted in distinctive Special Forces Tiger suits. Their purpose was to independently operate and give the battalion a long-range reconnaissance and ambush element. The Tigers were very flexible and were organized into long-range patrol teams and patrolled areas well out in front of other U.S. units. They worked in one or two platoon ambushes, operating in 15-man patrols armed with as many as 8 M60 machine guns in order to destroy Viet Cong ambushes. Because of their mission assignments, Tiger Force was given the latest equipment and best soldiers in the battalion. Quote, "We did recon, ambush, search, and destroy. We spent 58 days on Hill 51, a little mountain in the middle of a rice paddy, waiting for an MBA regiment or something to come through, and when it was coming. After we got off the hill, we went forward, and in September of 66, we hit a POW camp and got out 40 South Vietnamese prisoners of war. They had been treated really bad. The Viet Cong would go into a village and catch the people, take them out to the jungle, and make them prisoners," Carnero said. Carnero came home on leave in December of 66 and went back to Vietnam for the next 6 months. During this time, the Tiger Force unit would go hide behind enemy lines and observe what the enemy was doing. Quote, "One mission we were sent out on was supposed to be for 5 days. Well, it turned into 9 days. We ran out of food and water. The captain asked for volunteers to go find water. I was one of them. We took off with the canteens and a 5-gallon bucket. Finally, we found a small dripping of water in some rocks. We filled up the canteens and bucket. On our way back, we heard somebody coming, and we hid in the bamboo. We stayed there while the North Vietnamese soldiers went by. We came out of the bamboo and started moving again. I guess they heard us, and they started firing at us. We ran back to our platoon, and the captain told us to be quiet and stand fast," Carnero said. Through the night, two men were wounded while they were in an advanced position for observing when the North Vietnamese fired an RPG at them. Carnero and a couple of other team guys went out to get their weapons and radio. No extraction could be performed because of the nature of their mission. The team hunkered down throughout the night and at least got some supplies delivered to them the next day. In 1970, Carnero was back in the U.S. and going to drill sergeant school, starting the beginning of his 5 years of drill sergeant duty. From 1970 to 1975, Carnero was a rifle marksman instructor at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and Carnero also spent some duty time in Germany, where he was a platoon sergeant, learning how to lead his troops in the operation of armored personnel carriers. Carnero retired from the military in 1983 and came home to Monahans. In 1986, Carnero worked at the West Texas State School for a short time until he went to work as a postman for the Kermit Post Office, where he worked until his complete retirement in 2006. Thank you to all our veterans for your service to our country and your sacrifices to protect and preserve our freedom. Kids, Cow, and More event held October 28th. The inaugural Kids, Cow, and More event, Monday, October 28th, hosted by County Agents Haley Cowley and Dina Floyd, drew an impressive crowd of 737 attendees eager to delve into the world of agriculture. This engaging event welcomed third and fourth grade students from Monahans, Grand Falls, and Kermit, providing them with hands-on experiences in various agricultural sectors, including beef, cotton, wool, pecans, and the mobile dairy classroom. The interactive activities offered students a unique opportunity to understand the vital role agriculture plays in their communities. The event's success was made possible through the collaborative efforts of many individuals and organizations. Special recognition goes to presenters including Rebecca Taylor, Crockett County CEA FCH, Stacy Schoenfeld, and the West Pecos Cattle Women's Association, Brad Easterling, IPM agent, Kimberly Cervantes, District 6 Pecan Specialist, and representatives from Southwest Dairy Farmers. The dedicated 4-H youth who served as group leaders, Daisy Ford, Carly Ford, Kaylee Cowley, Holly Rasband, Livestock Ambassador, and Samantha Dansby also played a crucial role, along with Walker, Aubrey, and Ashley Antrim, who contributed their steers for the beef presentation. Additionally, Sandra Pierce's KKM Roadshow added a fun and educational dimension to the event, enriching the experience for all attendees. Local schools were instrumental in promoting agricultural awareness, emphasizing its significance in students' education. The event not only educated young participants, but also underscored the community's commitment to understanding and valuing the agricultural industry. The success of the Kids, Cow, and More event sets a positive precedent for future initiatives aimed at educating youth about agriculture and its essential contributions to society. For more information on upcoming events and agricultural programs, please visit the Texas AgriLife Extension website, or please reach out to Haley Cowley, CEA, Family and Community Health, Ward County, phone number 432-943-4112, or haley.cowley@ag.tamu.edu, or Dina Floyd, CEA, Agriculture, Natural Resources, Winkler and Loving Counties, phone number 432-586-2593, or dina.floyd@ag.tamu.edu. Stay connected through Facebook's Ward County Extension and 4-H and Winkler and Loving County 4-H.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.